Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. In agreeing to review a Mississippi law that would ban most abortions after 15 weeks, the Supreme Court has set in motion a path to overturn the nearly 50-year-old right to legal abortion in the U.S. Now, opponents and proponents of reproductive rights across the country and around the world await the final decision after an earlier draft was leaked in May that suggested the landmark 1973 Roe v. Wade would be upended. Today, we're talking about how we got to Roe v. Wade and how we could leave it behind if Roe is overturned. Mary Ziegler is a professor of law at UC Davis and author of the new book, Dollars for Life, The Anti-Abortion Movement and the Fall of the Republican Establishment. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Was the argument, or if we even want to call it an argument, was the issue of abortion always political?
Not in the way that it is now. So obviously, if you go back far enough to, you know, before the 19th century, abortion wasn't political at all. And even as recently as the 1970s, you couldn't really define clearly which was the pro-life or anti-abortion party, which was the pro-choice or abortion rights party. That's a much more recent phenomenon.
So back when Roe v. Wade, the decision in Roe v. Wade came out in 1973, what was the hue and cry or what was the reaction at the time?
Well, in a way, abortion was already a divisive issue. States had been battling about it for about a little under a decade at that point. But Roe was not a major blockbuster in the way we would expect now. On ABC News, the night the Roe decision came down, it was the third story in the lineup, just to give you a sense. When John Wow. Paul Stevens had his confirmation hearing 2 years later, he was asked a grand total of zero questions about Roe v. Wade and unanimously confirmed. So to get where we are today, on the one hand, it's fair to say there was always a movement against legal abortion well before Roe existed. But for Roe to be the explosive issue it is today wasn't something that was inevitable, and it wasn't something that happened immediately after the decision.
As far as the opposition back in the day in the 70s when Roe v. Wade was being considered and then was ruled on, was it a religious issue?
I think for some, I think it was certainly a moral or secular issue for some as well. It's fair to say most historians would tell you that in the early '60s and '70s, the strongest or the sort of home base of the pro-life or anti-abortion movement at the time was largely sort of Northeastern and Midwestern Catholic strongholds. Over time, by the late '60s, early '70s, there were some other folks who joined the movement as well. There were some Mormons, some Protestants, some Orthodox Jews, although I think the movement remained predominantly Catholic until the 80s when white evangelical Protestants joined. But it was a very different movement, right? It was not, was weak in the South, for example, something we would never expect today.
Yeah, and frankly, I mean, growing up Catholic in the Midwest, I don't remember it ever being brought up in mass.
Right. Well, it wouldn't have been. I think there was a religious component in the sense that, right, the strongest national anti-abortion group, the National Right to Life Committee, had its roots in the Catholic Church, and the then National Conference of Catholic Bishops. But many Catholics were not focusing on abortion, weren't primarily discussing abortion. So I think, again, that's the, you know, Roe being the third story on the night it came out. People wouldn't have thought this was as big of a deal back then, as they do today.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about the history of Roe v. Wade, the history of abortion rights in the United States. My guests, we're very lucky to have Mary Ziegler. She's a professor of law at UC Davis and author of the new book, Dollars for Life, The Anti-Abortion Movement and the Fall of the Republican Establishment. Coming up this hour, if you have questions about the history of abortion rights in the United States, give us a call. We'll have others on that can address specific questions later in the program, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. Yeah, the third in the lineup on a national news program, that is kind of startling. When did was it in the 80s when evangelicals, Protestants got involved that it became to be more solidified as a larger movement with legs?
In a way, I mean, the movement was already pretty effective before Roe. So, I mean, one of the most stunning victories it won in the 70s was that abortion opponents in New York State almost succeeded in reinstituting criminal law in that state And ironically, the only thing that stopped it was a veto by a Republican governor, just to tell you how foreign the world was to what we're familiar with. But it certainly fortified the movement in the early 80s when the movement was able to align both with the Republican Party, which became the first party to essentially say, we'll actually champion this cause, when Ronald Reagan took up the banner, and with white evangelicals who had been uncomfortable before with what they largely viewed as a Catholic cause, and who had been kind of, at least at the official level of the groups like the Southern Baptist Convention, ambivalent about abortion, right? So opposed to the idea of, for example, of abortion on demand, but also supportive of legal access to abortion under narrow circumstances like rape and incest. So when that began to change, the movement got a big infusion of cash, got a big infusion of political support, and got important new partners that would help to make it into the force we see now.
My recollection back in the day, the Republican Party was pro-choice because it was stay out of the bedroom, let people run their own lives kind of a thing.
Yeah, it was divided, right? So, I mean, you had pro-choice and pro-life Republicans, you had pro-choice and pro-life Democrats. I mean, Joe Biden back in the day would probably not have been fully a pro-life Democrat, but would certainly not have been considered a pro-choice Democrat either based on his voting record. So neither party was really coherent on this issue. You know, so for example, when Gerald Ford was president in 1976, you know, he, or not in 1976, sorry, when he was took over from Richard Nixon after Watergate, he was working with a pro-choice Republican as vice president. When George McGovern ran for president, right, he ran with a pro-life Democrat as his running mate. So no one really thought that either party had a consistent agenda at the time.
Was there much polling done before 73 on the issue of abortion in the United States?
A little bit, yeah. We have some polling because states were beginning to consider changing their laws. And it tells us that you know, opinion in the 60s and 70s was becoming more favorable toward legal abortion, and not, again, in a predictable partisan way. So some polls, for example, found that Republicans were a little more likely to support legalizing abortion than Democrats were in the late 60s.
So the pro-choice movement, could we talk about that for a second and how that came to be? Was it mostly legal affairs people at a certain point and not the larger cultural, didn't have the larger cultural thrust that it has now?
Yeah, it was definitely more, you know, small C conservative in some ways, right? So some of the early proponents of legal abortion were doctors who simply said, you know, people in the world, doctors are already performing abortions other than just to save the life of the pregnant person. And the law should reflect what doctors think is best practice. And often they didn't want really broad access to abortion, just modest changes. There were also some folks in what was called the population control movement who thought that abortion should be legal as a way to preserve environmental resources or maybe prevent international and domestic population growth, which they thought was connected to poverty or losing the Cold War. There were certainly some in the population control movement, even with what we would consider sort of racist aims. And there were grassroots feminists as well. They tended to join later, but by when they did, they quickly became, I think, the leading force in the movement. There were more of them involved in the movement. So again, the pro-choice movement was sort of in flux in the pre-Roe years as much as the anti-abortion or pro-life movement was.
And what was the scenario of illegal abortions, the quote-unquote back alley abortion situation? What was that like back then, before Roe v. Wade?
Well, I think it of course, depended on who you were. People in with more resources had an easier time because they could travel to places where abortion was legal, or they could navigate the hurdles in states with limited access to abortion. For people with fewer resources or people who are afraid of disclosing that they were having abortions, it was more dangerous. So we know that, you know, morbidity and mortality were higher among people of color, for example, in part because they had fewer resources, potentially in part because of stigma. Generally, at the time Roe came down, maternal mortality had declined some. So the problem with people dying of illegal abortions was less acute than it had been decades ago. But it was still something that people had to be afraid of. And I think many people At the time of reproductive age, new people who had had troubles finding a legal abortion or new people who had had complications from an illegal abortion. So it kind of loomed large in people's minds.
What was the legal philosophy that links the issue of abortion with birth control or reproductive, reproductive choice? Yeah.
Well, so there were different ways that this got done. So some Catholics in the early pro-life movement, right? So before the late 60s, had connected birth control and abortion as kind of a matter of faith. Those arguments faded away by the late 60s, but they were replaced by arguments about what abortion means. So we may all think we agree on what abortion is, but it's been contested, especially when it comes to things like emergency contraceptives or sort of new contraceptive technologies like IUDs when they were first marketed. So there were questions about whether those drugs were in fact abortion inducing. And some people may remember a recent iteration of this debate when the Affordable Care Act's contraceptive mandate was being debated. Some religious employers objected, not because the mandate covered birth control, but because they thought it covered abortion inducing drugs.
People have talked about since the leaked draft came out, you know, gave everybody who supports abortion rights time to pause and wonder what's next after abortion. Is there any reason to think there's some kind of slippery slope out there as far as our privacy goes, our personal privacy goes?
Yeah, I mean, it's complicated, right? So the Supreme Court, at least if the draft is any indication, is trying to kind of wall off abortion and say, hey, you know, abortion is different because it's the taking of a human life. And the court could absolutely stick to the abortion is different argument. I think the concern or the question for people is that the court's reasoning, which is essentially our constitutional rights are bounded by history and tradition. Mm-hmm. And to answer the question of what constitutional rights we have, we're going to look to the late 19th century. If that's really how we define constitutional rights, if the court is really going to be consistent about that, it's not clear how different abortion is, because, of course, in the late 19th century, same-sex couples didn't have the right to marry, same-sex sex was criminalized, birth control was criminalized, interracial marriage was criminalized, and we know at least that some of the justices, including Justices Alito and Thomas, have said, you know, recently that the court's decision on same-sex marriage was wrong and should be overruled. So I think if you're talking about, you know, is the court going to overrule all of those decisions quickly? I mean, absolutely not. Mm-hmm. But I've been taught from years of following the Supreme Court, when then the Supreme Court throws in a disclaimer about, hey, you know what, we're not going to do all this other stuff. Mm. Don't worry about that. They tend to not be good on that promise. Right?
So it means somebody's thinking about it.
Right. Well, I mean, just to give you an example, when the rules were reversed, the court had a more progressive majority in 2003 decided you couldn't criminalize same-sex intimacy, threw in a disclaimer saying, hey, you know what, we're not going to legalize same-sex marriage. Don't worry about that. All the conservatives in dissent said, we don't really believe you. And then, of course, fast forward to 2015, and that's exactly what they did. So these disclaimers I take more as a sort of, so they have an expiration date, put it that way. Like, they may not be a guarantee for very long.
And the idea of tradition when it comes to the Constitution looking through that lens of tradition, is there a metric on that? I mean, who decides what length of time constitutes it being a tradition?
Yeah, I think that's one of the things that's complicated, and who gets to comprise the tradition, right? Yeah. Because for the court, the answer is the people who are governing at the time of the 19th century. And some bystanders, you know, people who are not lawyers pointed out, well, I mean, who could govern in the 19th century, right? Women couldn't vote. People of color in many states were functionally prevented from voting. And so in a way, obviously the court's answer would be, that's a perfectly legitimate objection, but you have to go take care of that at the ballot box. That's not the Constitution. But I think for other people, it's disturbing that our constitutional tradition is defined and limited by, you know, a pretty narrow subset of Americans at the time, definitely not the entirety of we the people.
And then after Roe v. Wade was decided in 73, how can you give me a sense about how fast the abortion rights industry, if you will, ramped up in states around the country?
It took a little while. So there were no, I mean, not no, but very few abortion clinics in the immediate aftermath of Roe. So more than half of abortions at that point were taking place in hospitals, which was pretty limiting because there were obviously Catholic hospitals that didn't want to perform abortions, hospitals in more conservative states that didn't want to perform abortions. But things ramped up pretty quickly. So there were, you know, several hundred clinics, I think about 500, if I'm not getting my numbers wrong, later in the 1970s. And by 1982, over 80% of abortions were happening in clinics. And of course, clinics had the advantage from the standpoint of folks who supported abortion rights of facilitating access, but they also had the downside of, you know, literally, physically, and symbolically isolating abortion from other medical practices. And that, of course, I think was going to be consequential for people who opposed to abortion in the years going forward.
And then on the other side of the coin, if Roe v. Wade is overturned, how fast do the clinics that provide abortion in states that have, say, for example, trigger laws already in place? I guess it just depends on state by state how fast they have to shut down and.
Mm-hmm. Right. I mean, some states, it's not even clear, right?
Right.
Some trigger laws don't really explain how, you know, they say if Roe v. Wade is overturned, the law goes into effect, but there's not much guidance on who decides when that happens. Other states are much clearer. Usually those states have some kind of certification process from the attorney general. Usually that takes place within about 30 days of a decision. So all of this is going to happen very quickly. And we have some guidance from what happened with Texas and SB 8. Mm-hmm. There we saw lots of abortion clinics shutting down ahead of or in anticipation of, right? So we would expect to see even before trigger laws go into effect in some conservative states, some clinics closing down because the types of penalties people could face under some laws are so sweeping that people don't want to come close to violating these laws.
Mary Ziegler, thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Mary Ziegler is a professor of law at UC Davis, and her new book is titled Dollars for Life, The Anti-Abortion Movement and the Fall of the Republican Establishment. We're going to get on with it, so stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Dan Fisher. We're looking at the history of abortion rights and what lies ahead if Roe v. Wade is overturned. Jesse Hill is Associate Dean for Research and Faculty Development, and the Judge Ben C. Green, Professor of Law at Case Western Reserve University School of Law. She's a nationally recognized reproductive rights expert. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
Supporters of abortion rights felt that the fact that the court even took on the Mississippi case was a troubling sign for the future of Roe v. Wade. Why is that? I mean, do you agree? Do you know what they're talking about?
Absolutely, yes, absolutely. It was kind of like the first shoe dropping when that happened. It really woke people up and opened the possibility that the Supreme Court was going to overturn Roe v. Wade, which really hadn't seemed that realistic before. And part of the reason why is because the case was so clear that Mississippi passed this law banning abortion at 15 weeks, which is well before the fetus is viable. And if one thing has been clear since Roe v. Wade was decided, it's that states cannot ban abortion before the fetus is viable. And so the trial court struck down that Mississippi law. The very conservative Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals agreed and struck down that law, said the law is perfectly clear here. And then when the Supreme Court took that case, it was hard to read it any other way, because usually the court doesn't take really clear cases that reach the right answer just to reaffirm them. So it was already a really bad sign.
And can you explain to listeners what it wasn't? It was about the 15 weeks. And it was about viability, and it had already been struck down in two conservative courts. How does when the Supreme Court takes on a case like that and in that way, how do they justify it at the outset?
Well, that's a great question. I mean, the Supreme Court doesn't give any explanation for its decisions to take a case or not take a case. I mean, what was really interesting about how this developed is that Mississippi was trying to defend its law initially by saying, no, you know, we don't need to overrule Roe v. Wade. You don't need to change the law to uphold Mississippi's law. You can just sort of interpret it to make room for laws like Mississippi's. And it had all sorts of justifications for why its law actually was valid under Roe v. Wade and under subsequent cases. And then the case sort of sat there at the Supreme Court for a really long time. The Supreme Court took like a year to decide whether or not to hear this case. And during that time, the composition, the justices had changed. And so by the time the Supreme Court took the case, it looked a lot more likely that the justices who were on the court would be ready to actually just full on wholesale overturn Roe v. Wade. And because of that, when Mississippi finally briefed the case and the parties started submitting their briefs, Mississippi explicitly then asked the court to overrule Roe v. Wade and no longer emphasize the idea that, you know, that this law could be upheld under existing precedent.
Is it crass to suggest that the court was waiting for the composition of the court to change?
You know, it's really hard to know, again, because the court doesn't really explain itself. It is famously secretive, as we've all heard after in the wake of the really unusual leak of the draft opinion. You know, it's really hard to know what they might have been waiting for. I mean, some folks thought they would wait or at least would not take this case until the 2022 election was over, but that didn't turn out to be true. So it's not really possible to say what they were thinking.
And that year plus long wait sitting on the case is not necessarily that unusual.
It was kind of unusual that it was that long. So okay. The court often will take a party files a really significant petition request for the court to hear a case. The court will often, you know, wait a fairly long time before deciding, months maybe. They'll do what's called relisting it, where they kind of say, we're not going to decide yet, we'll decide later. That's not unusual for that process to drag on for a few months. In this case, it really did drag on an unusually long time, which again made people wonder what might be going on there.
I was just talking with Mary Ziegler about the professor of law at UC Davis about the issue of tradition that in the leaked draft, at least, Justice Alito refers to. And I'm kind of curious about what your thoughts are about the metrics of tradition. What does that mean? Is there a scientific description of tradition and how they apply it when it comes to the Constitution?
Right. No, there really isn't a science to this. And that's really one of the problems with this method is that, you know, tradition, right, it's easy to pick and choose, right, among the traditions you want to look at. It's easy among the timeframes that are relevant. I mean, generally, the court sort of says, well, the time when the amendment was adopted is particularly relevant, but it doesn't limit itself to that particular timeframe. And so often the court has been accused of engaging what people call law office history, because it's not really rigorous historical study. It's picking and choosing. I think the other problem with the history and tradition idea is, you know, how do we define the tradition that we're looking at? Do we define it as, you know, the right to abortion? Do we define it as the right to control one's ability to procreate? Do we define it as, you know, control over one's body? It's a very malleable concept in the end.
And I'm also thinking about the issue of privacy, which goes to the heart of it as well.
Right. And privacy, that was the original grounding for the Roe v. Wade decision. And again, looking at It was a principle the court found embodied in all of these aspects of the Constitution. So that's another way we can frame it.
Was the issue of privacy referenced in that draft, leaked draft decision?
Well, the court really kept the focus much more narrowly on the right to abortion. So basically, most of its intellectual energy was spent explaining why abortion itself is both different and not protected by our constitutional tradition.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about the historical backdrop of the pending Supreme Court decision on the Mississippi case that could overturn Roe v. Wade. If you have a question or comment, my guest is Jessie Hill. She's Associate Dean for Research and Faculty Development and the Judge Ben C. Green Professor of Law at Case Western Reserve University School of Law, and an expert, acknowledged national expert on abortion rights in the U.S. 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. And Charlotte, you're on the air. Welcome.
Yeah, good day. Thanks for taking the call. My question is, some time ago, I remember hearing a news report that Prime Minister Justin Trudeau of Canada made a comment that if they were going to reverse Roe v. Wade, Canada would be happy to help American women who needed and wanted an abortion. So my question is, this law and this business of some of these laws in some of these states state that even if the woman goes out of state, they're going to go and prosecute her when she comes back in state. How is this going to work out in our international relations with Canada?
Jessie Hill.
Well, yeah, it's an interesting question. So traveling out of the country and traveling out of the state is really something where there's not a lot of precedent around whether or not states can outlaw that sort of thing. So the first question is, does the state already outlaw doing things in other states or in other countries that might violate its own laws? Generally, they don't. But some states have talked about passing a specific law. Missouri has proposed one. It hasn't passed yet, but that would criminalize going out of state to seek an abortion. And then there's the second question that raises is, can they constitutionally forbid doing that? Or does that violate some constitutional principles like the constitutional right to travel? It really seems to fly in the face of just having a federal system, these United States of America. And that question is, there is really not a clear legal answer to it right now. I think we are in a brave new world right now. We just haven't seen states typically try to do that kind of thing, but there's every reason to think that they might in the future, and that we are gonna get some answers to that question.
Can you talk about what the arguments would be against going to another state to do something that's illegal in your state?
Well, I think that what states who want to do this will say is that the fetus is essentially a citizen of their state and that they have a right to protect that fetus. So they can sort of still, you know, in legal terms, exercise jurisdiction over that fetus, even when it travels out of state, and over the person who's carrying that fetus. And so that would be the way that they would justify their authority to criminalize that conduct.
Is there anything in history that suggests what kind of enforcement could be brought to bear? Because this was not the case before. Back pre-1973, if you had the means and wanted to, you could go to New York or wherever to get an abortion, right? And no one was interested in trying to stop you. They just wouldn't let you do it in Michigan or Ohio.
Right. I think that the kind of enforcement, I mean, again, you're right. It's sort of unprecedented. I suspect that the sorts of things that those states might, you know, the ways that those states might enforce is if people report that this happened, right? So when people, if Ohio were to criminalize going out of state, which, you know, it has not indicated any intention to do that yet, but if it were to do that, I think the idea would be that when people come back to the state, if if a prosecutor, if a police officer finds out that that's what happens because someone told them, that, you know, that's the most likely scenario where that could come up. I mean, there are more frightening and sort of, you know, possible scenarios as well around, you know, there are people getting information from like tracking app, health tracking apps and things like that, or GPS tracking apps, and subpoenaing this information and trying to find out who's traveling out of state for these purposes. You know, we don't see this, you know, states could, for example, be trying to do this with marijuana.
Yeah, which is, yeah.
Right. And they just don't. And why don't they? Mostly it seems like they just don't think it's probably a worthwhile use of resources, right, to try to track down people who go out of state and ingest drugs that are illegal in Ohio. Again, it's a question whether they could decide, though, to start doing that with something like abortion, which maybe some states will see as being more politically beneficial to do.
Well, let's take a break. My guest is Jessie Hill. She's Associate Dean for Research and Faculty Development and the Judge Ben C. Green, Professor of Law at Case Western University School of Law. We're talking about the history of abortion pre-Roe v. Wade and the equation is going forward as we await the Supreme Court decision on the Mississippi case that could overturn Roe v. Wade. So stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We are looking at the history of abortion and during the Roe v. Wade decision in 1973 and what lies ahead if Roe v. Wade is overturned by the U.S. Supreme Court. My guest is Jessie Hill. She's Associate Dean for Research and Faculty Development and the Judge Ben C. Green, Professor of Law at Case Western Reserve University School of Law. Questions or comments about this, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. We were also talking earlier, and I'm interested in your thoughts, Jessie Hill, about this possible slippery slope. So once they, depending on how they write the final draft, and if they do overturn Roe v. Wade, of course, what it could mean for things like birth control, certain types of birth control, same-sex marriage, you know, on down the line.
Yeah, I mean, I think that I did hear my friend Mary talking a little bit about this, and I think I mostly have a very similar take. But I think, you know, it's important to recognize that at least if the opinion says what the draft opinion said, that there's really no way to distinguish between the logic where the Supreme Court overturns the right to abortion and all of these other rights around access to contraception, around the right to marry. I mean, even the right not to be sterilized against your will, mm-hmm. By the government is really bound up with that same right to terminate a pregnancy. And if we're going to look at history and tradition, and that's the main source of rights, you know, all of those rights are on the table again then, because none of those things were protected in the 18th and 19th centuries and earlier in U.S. and British legal tradition.
Let's see. Susan in Clintonville, you're on the air. Hi, Susan.
Hi. I had an abortion in Mexico in 1970. I lived in Texas at the time. And I became extremely ill when I returned. I was not able to seek medical treatment, or I would have been prosecuted. And I had to seek treatment from an African-American doctor who treated me in his home in West Austin. And he saved my life. and he saved my ability to have further children down the road. I am so distressed by what is about to happen in this country. I have two daughters, both of whom are married to dual citizens, and I am encouraging them both to leave the country. That's where I am.
Susan, thank you. I appreciate you sharing that story. Thanks for that. Wow, Jesse Hill.
Yeah, thank you for sharing that. I think that there are a lot of folks out there who are having very similar feelings about what's about to happen. I mean, you know, the one thing I think I can add from a legal perspective about all of this that is really terrifying is that on the one hand, most of the laws that are on the books right now say that the actual person who has the abortion can't be prosecuted criminally. Now, again, that could change. It's not the case now, but those people are not being threatened, but they are threatening providers, and they provide very narrow exceptions for life-saving abortions, medically necessary abortions. And so I think there is going to be a lot of concern among folks who may be in a position to provide abortions in even those situations that if they, depending on how they interpret the law, that they may be still prosecuted for how they, you know, for going forward with an abortion. And we've seen that in other countries where abortion is made illegal, but there are, you know, narrow exceptions for life-saving abortions that doctors just won't do them because it's too risky. There's too much risk of being prosecuted. The law's not clear enough, or they just worry about being second-guessed. I guess the one other thing is that I can say that there are methods of self-managing an abortion with pills in particular that are a lot safer than what was around in the 1960s, 1970s. But, you know, we just don't know how this is all going to play out and how many people are going to be able to get access to those safer methods and how many people are still going to be really, suffering and dying as a result of abortion bans.
Do you envision restrictions on insurance coverage for aftercare? Medicare or not Medicare, but Medicaid coverage for aftercare?
Wow, that is not something that I have heard being proposed. I mean, there are already insurance restrictions all over the place on actually covering abortion.
But say I have a complication, right?
Right. I mean, again, you know, as things have been, because there's kind of an attempt to make these laws look less punitive toward the actual person who had the abortion, maybe we won't see measures like that. But again, I think doctors are going to be very leery about providing that care anyway, and are going to, you know, be leery about how they have to justify providing it, whether it's to an insurance company or elsewhere.
I just read that there's been a spike in abortions in the United States. Now, this isn't like some knee-jerk reaction to the fear of, I mean, because first you have to get pregnant, right? So, but what do you make of that? What, any thoughts about that?
Yeah, I mean, it's always hard to know, and these things are famously hard to draw causal connections around because there's so many factors. I mean, I think things show that, or studies tend to indicate that abortion rates go up when the economy, during tough economic times. You know, there was during COVID and during the pandemic, there were all kinds of issues, both in terms of people being out of work and people having trouble accessing healthcare, that that certainly could have played a role. Although I know that the spike goes back a little further than that. So, you know, it's hard to know, but a lot of times it does tend to go along with economic difficulties.
Women who seek abortion in the U.S. are disproportionately low income. The New York Times reported that in 2014, half of all women seeking an abortion were low income, double the proportion from 1994, which is kind of interesting to me given how expensive it's become and how complicated it's become.
Yeah. But I mean, I think that the reality is that folks who are not low income just have gotten much better access to birth control. They have an easier time accessing
the more reliable forms of birth control. And then of course, being able to access them continuously, being able to pick up the pill every month, right, from the pharmacy, for example, is a lot easier in that if you have more means, basically. And that's another reason I think that tells the story of, we talked about the spike, but before the spike in abortion rates, there was this huge decline. And again, a lot of folks think that's because the Affordable Care Act really opened up access to contraception, and particularly to more effective, longer-term forms of contraception like IUDs and so on. So I think it's, you know, I think a big part of the story is that people with less means can't afford to have children, but I think it's also that they don't have as good access to healthcare, including contraceptive care.
If Roe v. Wade is overturned in the next week or so, what is the next? Where does the movement, the pro-abortion rights legal movement, go from there? I guess it depends on what the decision says, right?
Partly it depends on what the decision says. Although I think if it says what the leaked draft opinion said, which is every state can essentially decide abortion policy for itself, I think what that is really going to mean is that the fight moves to the state level. That's my sense. So every state is going to be different. In some states, there are going to be political options. There are going to be ballot initiatives. There are going to be legislative fights. In other states, you know, maybe the state court system is a way of trying to vindicate reproductive rights, and there could be strategies under state constitutions. So it's really going to be a much more decentralized movement, I think, than it has been in the past.
It's going to be, does it have to be, given the way they're presenting it or appear to be presenting it?
Yeah, I mean, I think that the one, you know, national option on the table is for the federal government to pass a law that would recodify Roe v. Wade and protect abortion rights nationwide. And that, you know, that really is kind of the golden snitch. Everybody would love to
fat chance is what I call
it. Right. Exactly. Equally right, likely to get caught. So I think and then even if it did pass, it would probably be challenged right away, go up to a Supreme Court that would likely be pretty hostile to this attempt. So it's a long shot, to say the very least.
For supporters of abortion rights, what is your expectation about how they're going to react? I mean, what are people in the rights legal movement talking about as far as what the reaction will be?
Well, I mean, I think the one thing is that we really have been expecting, folks on that side really have been expecting this for a while. So going back to when the Supreme Court took the case, as we discussed, that was already a sign. I think what's been going on in Texas and the Supreme Court's refusal to intervene against the Texas law that has really essentially created a pre-Roe situation in Texas, I think that has given folks reason to really start preparing for what a post-Roe world looks like. And I think it's going to be a whole new set of strategies. I think there folks are going to be looking at the right to travel, again, trying to protect interstate access, trying to protect medications that can provide abortions and access to those, which could have, again, some federal protections as well. So I think that there are going to be massive efforts in those involved in this movement to get patients who need abortions to places where they can access them.
I was talking to clinics and information organizations that help funds that help women find the right situation for them if they want to get an abortion, think about an abortion, help them with whatever they need. What do you see happening in Ohio regarding those kinds of groups? Any thoughts?
Yeah, I think that those groups are not going anywhere. I think they're going to stick around. I think they're going to continue helping people who need abortions and whatever that looks like. So, you know, in Ohio, we are considered one of the states that is really likely to ban abortion completely or almost completely in the coming weeks and months. Although, you know, nothing's 100%, but I think that while there is still access in Ohio, I think those groups will be focused on getting people quickly in to see abortion providers within legal limits. And then if and when there isn't access in Ohio, helping them get out of state.
Haven't those kinds of groups been outlawed in Texas, essentially?
Well, Texas, under the SB8 law, Texas has tried basically to ban groups like this by calling them essentially aiders and abettors of abortion. Mm-hmm. They can still help people get abortions that are legal in Texas, which is right now before 6 weeks of pregnancy. They can also help people get out of state, although lately Texas has been making noise that it doesn't think that it's legal for people to go out of state either. And so I think they're setting up potentially another big legal showdown over that issue.
And the idea that most Americans think that women should have access to legal abortion under certain circumstances, and in Ohio, very much a majority of Ohioans believe that. Does that have any bearing on how things are managed in the future, or is that just pure politics at this point?
Yeah, I guess I think that's a we'll see what happens, because I think on the one hand, that's right. Ohioans are majority pro-choice. There's always, both in Ohio and nationwide, been a really small fraction of people who think abortion should be illegal in all circumstances. It's like between 10 and 20% of
right.
people who answer yes to that. Yeah. And nonetheless, we see the Ohio legislature considering a bill, it hasn't passed yet, but they are considering a bill that would ban abortion any stage of pregnancy, all circumstances, no exceptions, just a really narrow defense for essentially life-saving and medically necessary abortions. And you know, I think that we really see how much the legislation is out of line with what Ohioans think and want. And I think, you know, that is a whole other story that could go back to it's intertwined with the story of political gerrymandering in Ohio and
right.
how the legislature really does not reflect here and in a lot of states
right.
what people's preferences would be.
Brad in Clintonville, you're on the air. We're running out of time, so I wanted to squeeze you in.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. A few years ago, a Chris Matthews interview with Donald Trump, the question was asked of Donald Trump, do you think that women who get abortions should be punished? At that time, his answer was yes. And I'm wondering if the guest thinks that attitudes like that from such powerful people might lead towards greatly more punitive actions should Roe v. Wade be overturned.
Thank you. Yeah, I think it's, again, it's something we have not seen lately or yet, but I think that we very well might be seeing that sort of thing soon. I think the program on the anti-abortion side was never just to return the decision to states. I think it was always to outlaw abortion in all circumstances, you know, across nationwide or almost all circumstances. And so I think that's probably where they're heading next.
I mean, obviously, if you're saying the pro-abortion rights folks will head to the states and focus on states, likewise will the anti-abortion rights folks.
Right. Exactly.
It's a two-sided equation. And just we have about a minute left, but any sense about what the ruling, if it follows the leaked draft ruling, what it means for the image of and the public perception of the U.S. Supreme Court?
I think it's already damaged the Supreme Court's reputation. It is really hard not to see this decision as political. As soon as they had the majority to overrule Roe v. Wade, they took a case and they did it, and they are overturning 50 years of precedent. I think the Supreme Court's really going to take a hit over this.
Jesse Hill, thanks so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
Jesse Hill is an Associate Dean for Research and Faculty Development and the Judge Ben C. Green Professor of Law at Case Western Reserve University School of Law. That we've been talking about the history of abortion and what to expect in the legal realm going forward if Roe v. Wade is overturned in coming days by the U.S. Supreme Court. Thanks so much for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.